because some part of her thought that maybe she could also keep some piece of Tommy's childhood intact. As if it was bottled, too, in the bright pink container. When the truth was, it was already gone. Gone where? Mr. Bubble grinned at her, an insane smile. She turned on the water. It thundered in her ears. Her mind flashed back to Tommy, gasping for air, calling out for her in the watery blackness, Mama! Focus on the water. You'll be all right. She put her hand under the stream to ground herself and poured the remains of the Mr. Bubble into the water, the bubbles proliferating in the tub, bursting to life.
Is that bubbles?
Noah jumped off the toilet and leaned over the side of the bathtub. Yep.
Ooh, can I get in?
Sure. He stripped off the rest of his clothes and then seemed to hesitate. He perched on the edge of the tub.
It's not too cold, is it?
No, honey, it's nice and warm.
Oh. Okay.
He nodded to himself as if making a decision, then lowered himself into the tub and began swatting at the bubbles.
When I was Tommy, we always did bubbles.
It never ceased to amaze her when he said things like that.
Yes.
You two boys always made a big old mess. He laughed.
We did.
Focus on the love. You'll be all right. She closed her eyes for a moment and remembered Charlie and Tommy going at each other in the tub with the bubbles, the soapy water oozing onto the floor. She held on to that feeling until the whole room seemed to vibrate with the force of her love for them, how much there was. The water was still pouring down over and through her fingers, changing moment by moment. As a child, she'd seen a movie about Helen Keller, how she had felt water running from a pump and had finally connected the name to the source of the name. But now she was going in the opposite direction, and names were losing their sense. What was Noah or Tommy, and who was she? Her head roared with a bright confusion.
Hey, look!
He was calling for her. Whatever she was to him, she wasn't a stranger. There were no strangers.
Look, Noah said. Look at this bubble!
The shine of the faucet pierced her eyes. Denise looked over, a beat too late.
Oh, popped. Sorry,
Noah said. Okay.
Look, bubble!
This time she looked over quickly.
I see it,
Denise said. That's a big one. It was a big one. It spanned the distance between his knees, growing bigger and bigger as he moved his legs apart, shimmering like crazy for its split second of existence.
Look!
The bubble grew larger still. In the ever-changing map of its colors, someone was drowning and someone was being born.
Oh, popped.
Yes. There was nothing to hold on to anymore. Only everything. Noah looked down, then, and put his whole face in the water. He lifted his head. He had a bubble beard and a bubble mustache, and he was grinning away like a demonic baby Santa Claus.
Guess who? He said.
Denise smiled.
I don't know, she said.
Who?
Me.
Chapter 42. It was late by the time they got home from the airport. Charlie sat next to his mom as they pulled into the driveway. Another night on Asheville Road, same old sounds of crickets and the Johnson's TV playing an Indians game. Crazy that it seemed the same when what was in his head had changed so much. He guessed that was how life was. Who knew what was in anybody's mind? And meanwhile, people died and had whole new lives, like the fireflies that arrived in June, flashing here, then gone, then here again. It was like some kind of batshit magic trick. Charlie had spent hours catching fireflies with his brother when they were little. Tommy would run around the yard with a jar, Charlie right at his heels. Once they'd caught a few, they'd put the jar on the steps and sit, watching them buzz and spark. They always pitched a fit when it was time to let them go. They wanted to keep them as pets, even though their mom explained that they'd die that way, that they belonged in the wild. One night, Tommy and Charlie couldn't take it anymore. They lied and hid the jar under Tommy's bed, and the next morning they had woken up to find themselves the owners of 3 dead bugs in a jar. Dry, ugly, black-winged things that looked like ordinary beetles, as if someone had come in the night and drained the mystery right out of them. Now Charlie wondered if the kid, Noah, ever saw fireflies in the city, or if he remembered them, even though he wasn't Tommy. Not really. He looked sideways at his mom. What was she thinking? He knew it was probably about his brother, but sometimes lately she surprised him. She'd ask his opinions about things, like what kind of food they should serve at the reception, or whether they should ask his dad over for dinner. "Why so curious what I think, all of a sudden," he wanted to say, "when you haven't given a rat's ass for the last 7 years?" And it was a problem, too, because it meant he couldn't get stoned as much. He'd had a quick toke or two in the garage the day before the burial, and she'd noticed in, like, half a second, not even. She looked him right in the eyeballs, and he was grounded before he even knew what hit him.
Denise stared out the window shield into the darkness, pondering gradations of loss. She would always miss Tommy. There was no stray piece of her that wasn't always missing him. But this other child, this child who was not Tommy, had brought a sweet taste to a mouth that had been filled with bitterness. They had been through it, the two of them. And there was that bond that she knew would always be between them. When they'd said goodbye at the airport, he had held on to her for a long time, and she was surprised to realize she couldn't speak for a minute. Finally, she'd said, "I'll see you in Brooklyn." "Okay." "Will you show me your room?" He nodded. "I've got stars in my room." "Stars, really?" "They're glow-in-the-dark stickers on the ceiling, all the constellations. My mom put them up there." "Well, I can't wait to see them." She made herself smile. She was still holding Noah by the shoulders, and he had his hands on her waist, as if they were dancing. She didn't want to let go of him. She wasn't sure she could. Around her, the other figures were insubstantial, blurry. She saw Janie glancing at her watch and Dr. Anderson speaking softly to Charlie. Then Charlie put his heavy hand on her back and said, "Come on, Mama. They've got to get to their gate." And she knew she had to do it. Let go. And she let him go. The three of them walked away from her and stood at the end of the security line. Dr. Anderson, a stiff man like her father had been, of that same breed, farmers and doctors who took their jobs seriously, who had kindness in them under all that proper bearing. And Janie, another mother who was doing her best with the job she was given. And that little boy with the yellow hair, for whom she had some love in her heart. No use denying it. Let go. For goodness sake, Denise. She'd kept her shit together while the winds of hell were blowing fiery sparks into her mouth. She could certainly keep it together now. She forced herself to watch as they joined the line of people, carrying whatever they were allowed to bring with them on their way from this place to the next. Beside her, Charlie stood up tall, like a man, and she was grateful for his steadying hand. Now she glanced at him in the car. He was looking out the window, having his Charlie thoughts. What did that boy think about? She'd have to find out. She'd have to ask him. He was drumming a beat with his fingers on the window pane. Maybe he was thinking about Henry. All these years he'd been the one insisting that she had to face it, that Tommy was dead and never coming back, and yet the discovery of Tommy's bones had completely undone him. He'd never believed in the death penalty, thought it was unfairly applied and racially skewed. But now he was bitter that the prosecution wasn't talking about it for Tommy's murderer, who had been so young at the time. Death consumed him. Still, maybe she'd call him and ask him to come over for dinner. And if he said no, she'd keep trying. And one of these days he might do it. What she had said to Henry at the graveside was true. She did miss Tommy every second of every day. She missed him. And yet she felt his presence at the same time. Not in the other child, but all around. And she couldn't hold on to it or make sense of it any more than she could hold on to Tommy, any more than she could understand why she opened her heart so instantly to Noah, or why her love for Henry was an ache she couldn't get rid of. "You okay, Mama?" He'd been watching her. He was always watching her, her Charlie. She turned around to face him. "I'm fine, honey, I truly am. I just need another minute." "All right." She turned off the engine, and they sat in the driveway, in the dark.
Chapter 43. Only the goodbyes to get through, Anderson thought, as he passed into the busy throng of humanity waiting for loved ones at the baggage claim. All around them, families craned their necks eagerly, or fell upon their relatives with cries and hugs and handfuls of balloons. Fathers lifted daughters high up in their arms. People used to reunite at the gates, but that was a different era. Now people claimed each other and their luggage in this grim, cavernous space, calling out, "Mine. This is mine, the blue one. You're mine." A young beauty in cut-off blue jeans searched the crowd. An older, heavy-set woman stepped forward and enveloped her in her arms. Only the goodbyes to get through. And then,
"All set?"
Janie put a hand on his shoulder. They knew each other better now, had achieved that intimacy, whether he liked it or not. She was worried about him. He looked away.
"My car is in the parking lot." He gestured with his chin. "Do you want a lift?"
"We'll just take a taxi,"
she said, and he nodded, his mind crowing with relief. He would not have to speak then, not after the next few minutes. In his mind, he was already on the road in his car, moving through the quiet night.
"It's the wrong way for you," she added. "Or if you want, it's so late to drive, you can stay the night with us until morning. We have a pull-out couch."
"I'll be fine."
He avoided her eyes. There was too much warmth there. He didn't want her to care about him. He was already gone. He squatted down next to Noah.
"I'm going to say goodbye now, my friend."
"I don't like goodbyes," Noah said.
"Me neither," said Anderson. "But sometimes they are good."
He'd meant another word, but no matter.
"We'll see him again soon, though, Bug,"
Janie said, attempting a reassuring briskness.
"Won't we, Jerry?"
"It's possible."
"Possible?"
Janie's voice was higher than usual. He kept his focus on Noah. Noah seemed to be managing this separation better than his mom. Maybe by now he was used to it.
"You mean probable, right?"
"No, Janie," he thought. "This time I said the word I meant to say."
"I think you'll be so busy having fun, you'll forget all about me," he said to Noah.
"No, I won't forget. Will you forget me?"
The boy looked anxious. He put his hand on Noah's head. His hair was soft beneath his fingers.
"I won't. But it's okay to forget, sometimes," he said gently.
The boy took this in.
"Will I forget about Tommy, too?"
"Do you want to?"
Noah considered.
"Some things I want to. Some things I don't."
His small, clear voice was barely audible among the people milling around them.
Can I choose which ones to remember?
He'd miss this child.
We can try, Anderson said. But we can't forget about now, Noah. The moment we're in. The life we're in, that's more important. We can't forget that.
Noah laughed incredulously.
How could you forget that?
I don't know.
Anderson was still squatting, and it was hurting his knees. The boy touched his forehead to his and seemed to peer right into him. He smelled like the lollipop the flight attendant had given him on the plane.
You don't know a lot.
That's true.
He looked at Noah. The case was almost complete. There was only one thing left. How fascinating that he had not asked about it before.
Can you do something for me?
I know it's odd, but can I see your chest and your back?
Just for a second. Would you mind? Is it okay?
He turned now to Janie, who had been listening to their conversation. She nodded. He stood up, pulled Noah away from the people, against a dormant carousel, out of view. An adult would have asked why, but Noah simply lifted his t-shirt. Anderson turned the child around carefully, looking at his pale chest and back. Two birthmarks, faintly visible. A faint, round circle on the back, slightly reddish, and a ragged star of raised skin in the front. The path of a bullet, written plain on the flesh. At another moment, he would have taken a picture of it, but now he simply let the t-shirt fall. The evidence was there. A large family at the next carousel was counting baggage. Two boys in soccer shirts were running gleefully around the carousel. His goodbye over, Noah ran and joined them in an impromptu game of airport tag.
You can use it,
Janie said in a low voice. There was a certainty in her voice he hadn't noticed before. She had seen the marks on her son's skin.
For your book. You can write about Noah. You can use his first name.
Can I?
It was a question for himself.
I'm sorry I doubted you before. You have my permission, she said formally, to use his story any way you like.
He tilted his head in thanks. Perhaps there was enough juice left in him to finish this chapter if he did it quickly. He owed that much to the man he had been. The man he was now, though, who was that?
Do you think Noah is getting better?
Janie asked haltingly, the trust in her eyes as she looked at him both touched and alarmed him.
Do you?
She thought about it.
Maybe. I think so.
Noah and the soccer boys were doubled over with laughter.
Why did Tommy decide to come back in the States, do you think?
She said, her eyes on her son.
Why wasn't he reborn in China or India or England? You said once that people often reincarnate in the same area. But why?
She was puzzling over it earnestly, and he felt a kind of bemusement, as if all the questions that had buzzed about him for so much of his life had found a fresh new field to swarm.
There does seem to be a correlation.
He spoke slowly, picking each word with care.
Some children speak of spending time in the areas in which they died, picking their parents from the people that pass by. Others are born into their own families, as their own grandchildren or nieces or nephews. We have speculated that may be due to love.
There was a different word he wanted, a more clinical one, but it was out of reach.
Perhaps personalities love their countries, the way they love their families. He shrugged. How a consciousness migrates is not a question I've been able to answer. I've been stuck on establishing its existence.
He shifted his feet impatiently.
Listen, he said. It's been...
But I'm not sure what to do now.
She touched his sleeve, and the gesture startled him.
How do I go back and raise Noah now?
You rely on your intellect and your...
Again, the word eluded him.
Feelings. Your feelings are good.
He was whittled down now, either to banalities or simple truths. Either way, they would have to do.
We have to say goodbye now, he murmured.
You'll need to follow up with Noah's case, though, right?
I don't know, he thought, but he said, sure.
So, I can email you sometimes, if I have more questions?
He nodded, but barely.
Okay.
They eyed each other, at a loss for how to part. A hug seemed out of the question, but a handshake seemed too formal. At last, she held out her hand to him, awkwardly, and he held it briefly in his own large one and then on impulse raised it to his lips and kissed it. The skin was soft beneath his lips. It was the kiss of a father at a wedding, releasing his daughter from his care. He felt a pang of some obscure loss, either for her companionship or for womankind, so far behind him now.
Be well, he said, releasing her hand.
He grabbed his battered bag and headed out the doors into the warm night.
He was free. That's who he was. Free.
The cars and taxis slowed, pulling over to pick up relatives and customers, and he passed by them as he headed for the parking lot, enjoying his momentum, the way his legs swung smoothly, efficiently, his mind stretching out gratefully in the dark. He cared about Janie and Noah, but they were receding from him rapidly. His last case, and it was done. They were back there on the ground, and he was buoyed up. He had fought with everything he had to hang on to his life as he had once known it, and now it was gone, and he floated on the lightness of his defeat. He had applied the full force of his mind to his attempt to understand the unfathomable, and maybe he'd been able to extract one or two teeth from the maw of infinity, and now he had only to write out this last case. He had thought that as he grew nearer to his own death, the unanswerable questions would pierce him unbearably, and now he found to his shock and delight that he had no need for questions. What would happen, would happen.
How about them apples?
He would finish his book now, and then he could do what he liked. And when one day he could no longer read the Bard, then he'd go over the parts he had committed to memory, remembering the depth and cadence, if not the lines themselves. He could babble Shakespeare to himself under the oaks all day like a crazy man. Or he could go back to Asia. It'd feel good to be on Asian soil again. And what was stopping him? Nothing.
He could go now if he liked. He could take the next flight out. Thailand, the dense, humid air, the chaos of its streets. Why not go?
He felt the excitement beginning to pulse through him as he thought about it. He could visit the enormous reclining Buddha with its 108 auspicious signs carved in mother of pearl on the soles of his feet. He could start to meditate. He'd always been too nervous that a spiritual practice might undermine or influence his scientific objectivity, but that was irrelevant now. And if the Tibetans were right, then meditation could lead to a more peaceful death, which might positively influence his next life, though his own data was inconclusive on that score. Maybe he'd even stop at a beach. The PP Islands were supposed to be something to see. White sand like silk between your toes. Blue water clear as glass. The present moment. Surrendering to that. He'd heard you could take a boat ride and see the strange limestone outcroppings rising out of the mist like something in a Chinese scroll painting. Those scenes of painted mountains twisting up into the coiled, unseen sky, while one lone human lingered in a boat down below, so tiny as to be almost invisible. He'd have to buy a bathing suit. He couldn't wait.
Chapter 44 Janie leaned her head against the taxicab window, her arm around her dozing son, taking in the familiar sights. There was the broad expanse of Eastern Parkway, its apartment buildings, and yeshivas, and stately trees, the Met Foods where she bought groceries, and the dark swath of Prospect Park. The sameness surprised her, as if she had expected to find the world at home transformed. They passed the diner in which she'd met Anderson for the first time, where the waitress had YOLO tattooed on the back of her shoulders. You only live once. That's what people said, as if life really mattered because it happened only one time. But what if it was the other way around? What if what you did mattered more because life happened again and again? Consequences unfolding across centuries and continents. What if you had chances upon chances to love the people you loved, to fix what you screwed up, to get it right? They were outside her brownstone now. The gas lamp flickered in the night, like a friend happy to see her. She paid the driver and hauled her heavy, sleeping boy in her arms and out of the cab, feeling stung with gratitude that they were home and lived on the ground floor. In their apartment, Janie carried Noah straight into the bedroom and put him down on his bed without turning the lights on. She curled up beside him, facing him in the narrow bed, and pulled the comforter over them both. He stirred and rubbed his eyes, yawning. "Hey, we're home," he sighed, and nestled up against her. He threw his foot over her hip, placed his forehead against hers. He put his hand on her shoulder in the dark. "What part of the body is this?" he whispered. "That's my shoulder." "This?" "That's my neck." "And this is your noggin, noggin, noggin?"
"Yes."
Silence. Then a sound from deep beneath the bed covers. A sleepy grin.
"I farted."
And, like that, he was asleep again. Janie slowly got out of the bed. She moved quietly across the room and paused in the doorway. Noah shifted. He was on his back now, sleeping under the stars. They glowed above him. All the man-made constellations. That map that was all most of us could handle of the universe. That went on and on without end. Years ago she had placed the plastic decals up there, creating Noah's own Big Dipper, his own Orion. Thinking that for the rest of his life, when he saw the stars, he'd feel at home. She tried to remember herself as she had been then, but she couldn't go back, any more than she could mistake the pasted-up stars for the real. Noah's lips slid upward, as if he was having a very pleasant dream. She stood in the doorway for a long time and watched him sleep. Epilogue. Nothing about the trip to New York was what Denise had expected. For instance, the fact that Henry decided to come with her. That had floored her. You never knew what you'd get lately with Henry. There were days when he woke up whistling "Straight No Chaser" and made blueberry pancakes on Sunday mornings for Charlie and her. Other times, he stayed up all night, drinking beer in the living room, the TV on loud on any dumb show, and if she got up to check on him or ask him to turn it down, he growled at her to go back to sleep. She always made an effort the next morning to wake early and get herself together and go over her lesson plans for the day, because she knew it would take a while, pushing him out of bed and making sure he got himself dressed and on his way. Sometimes it felt like she had two surly teenagers in the house. It was amazing the three of them ever got to school on time. "This is me now. You want me? Fine, this is what you get. You don't? That's fine, too," he'd said when he offered to move back home. His face was hard, and he shrugged as he said it, as if it didn't matter much to him either way, but she'd seen right through him, as if he were one of her own children, saw plain as anything how much he wanted her to take him back, and how much she wanted it too. She was happy to have him back. He had that heaviness in him from Tommy's death. She didn't expect that would ever go away, but he could savor a plate of good food. And she found herself loving again the simple pleasure of cooking, putting a little of this in with some of that, and having it come out of the oven steaming,
the whole house smelling delicious, and then eating every bite of it. You're putting meat on your bones again. That's what Henry kept saying, poking her in the new soft layer over her ribs. And it was good for Charlie, that was clear. The boy was a clown, always had been, and she could see now how much artfulness there was in it. There was nothing she liked better at the end of a long day than seeing Henry throw his head back and send that belly laugh of his out over the dinner table after Charlie had said something funny, and the flush of pleasure stealing over Charlie's face as he ducked his head shyly, taking it in. Sometimes after dinner they played together in the garage, Charlie on drums and Henry on bass, the sounds vibrating through the walls and out into the neighborhood, drowning out even the neighbor's dog. And she felt that everything was probably going to be all right. They didn't talk about Noah. Neither of them wanted that fight. There was no winning it and no end to it. When spring rolled around and the idea of visiting Noah intruded into her thoughts as she went about her day, she pushed it aside at first, afraid to upset the new and delicate balance at home. She'd sent Noah a gift instead on Tommy's birthday, though she hadn't mentioned that in the card. She had talked to Noah a few times on the phone those first few months, but it was usually a disaster. Whether that was due to the boy's youth and natural impatience with the telephone or the oddness of the circumstances, she wasn't sure. He'd been eager to talk to her for the first 5 seconds, often pestering his mother to make the call. Yet he answered her questions about kindergarten in a shy, monosyllabic way, and, after reviving briefly to talk about Horntail, was clearly relieved to get off the phone a few moments later. It always took her the rest of the afternoon to recover from the intense feelings that followed. After a while, the calls had tapered off. By summer, she was determined to see Noah in person. She thought she could handle it now. Janie had agreed to it, though she sounded cautious. "He doesn't really talk about Tommy very much," she'd said. And Denise thought that was just as well. She booked the ticket before telling Henry. Charlie had a job at the Stop and Shop bagging groceries, and another as a lifeguard at the pool, so he couldn't come. When she told Henry she was going to New York to see Noah, he stood there wincing at the name. And she wondered if the risk was too great. "I'll go with you then," he'd said at last, as if he'd suddenly become somebody else's husband. "If that's all right. Got a couple old friends I want to look up." He had spent a few years there when he was young and a promising bass player. She let him come. She didn't ask any questions. She didn't want to know, maybe, what his real motives were. And she wanted his company. She had never been to New York. Another thing she hadn't expected, to have so much fun with him. Their first night in the city, they went to the Blue Note and got a seat right by the stage. They drank glowing blue drinks and listened to Henry's old friend Lou tearing it up with his sax, and then afterward they went out somewhere else with the band, laughing and drinking and eating cheap, good food till the early morning, listening to the musicians' easy banter and their stories about staying in somebody's cousin's house on the road with the smell of chitlins blasting from the kitchen, their tales of tightwad band leaders and musicians who stumbled out of the bathroom with their noses dusted white and their pants down. And that time Lou's Seattle girlfriend flew out to see him play in San Francisco and ran into both his Oakland and Los Angeles girlfriends that same night. Back at the hotel, she and Henry hungered for each other like the old days. The force of it surprised her. It was nice to find out that was still possible, after everything that had happened. She hadn't expected Henry to come with her to Janie's apartment the next day, or that Janie's apartment would be so small and old-fashioned. She'd imagined a big, modern loft like those New York apartments on television, not this quaint place with its ornate woodwork like something in her mother's house.
It was a hot day. When the two of them straggled in, Janie took one look at them and said, "Let me get you some water, or would you like iced coffee?" Denise shook her head. "Wish I could. If I drank coffee now, I'd be up till dawn." While Janie went to get their drinks, Denise stepped into the living room, where Noah was. He was almost 6. That tender age when the baby plumpness starts to melt away from children's bodies. And you can see, in their newly angular faces, the people they might become. He was absorbed in a book, sitting cross-legged on the couch, his hair bright and wild on his head. Why didn't she ever take that boy in for a haircut? He didn't seem to notice them. "Noah, look who's here," Janie said, when she came back with the waters, and he looked up. Denise stood in the middle of the room, clutching the gift she'd brought, feeling her mouth go dry, as Noah met her gaze with cheerful, unrecognizing eyes. She hadn't known until that moment how deeply she had cared. She hadn't expected that at all. "This is your Aunt Denise, don't you remember?" Janie said, stepping forward. "Oh, hi, Aunt Denise." He smiled politely, accepting her present and her presence in his life the way a child did, not questioning where she'd come from. She sat down and cradled the icy water in her two hands, as somewhere far away from her, Henry introduced himself to Noah, and the child ripped the wrapping from the box in two quick strokes. Inside was Tommy's old baseball glove. He pulled it out with a cry, "Hey, a new glove!" And she took pleasure and pain in his open, uncomplicated glee. They walked to the park. It was a bright day, the air kicking with a bit of wind.
"So, I've got one question for you," Henry said to Noah as they walked.
He turned to the boy with his gravest expression.
"Yeah?"
Noah looked up worriedly.
"Mets or Yankees?"
"Mets all the way," Noah said.
Henry grinned. "That's what I want to hear."
He high-fived the boy.
"What do you think about Grandy? Think he can bring it?"
That was all it took, apparently. They talked animatedly about baseball for the rest of the way to the park, while Janie and Denise walked quietly side by side. Denise was mute with disappointment.
"I'm sorry," Janie said, her voice low. "I didn't know what he would do when he saw you. He doesn't talk about it anymore, but I didn't know. I guess he's just Noah now."
They walked on a bit in silence.
"He still likes the things he likes, though," she continued. "Lizards and baseball and new things, too. You should see what he can make out of Legos, these beautiful buildings."
"He's like his mom," Denise said at last.
Janie blushed, shrugged. "He's happy." They got to the park and found an open stretch, a meadow. An elderly couple walked by arm in arm. A large Hasidic family moved down a path, corralling their children, keeping them from veering too close to the pond at the meadow's edge. People were feeding the ducks, a frenzy of beaks and crumbs. A girl stood in the grass twirling a hula hoop around and around, like someone from another time. Janie and Denise settled on a blanket under the protective limbs of a large tree and took out containers of oily mozzarella balls and hummus, grapes and carrots and pita chips, weighing down the napkins with the thermoses so they didn't fly away. They had brought a baseball with them and the glove, and while they set up the picnic, Henry and Noah crossed over into the open grass and tossed the baseball back and forth, Henry catching the ball in his bare hand, like he used to do. Denise watched him. Noah was happy, Denise could see that. It was nice to see him happy, like any child. It was for the best that he had forgotten her. Denise knew that, though knowing didn't make it hurt any less. She was grateful that nature had righted itself, but couldn't shake off the feeling that something had been taken away from her that might have been precious. If only she'd been able to find a way to make it so. She leaned back on her elbows under the fluttering green leaves. Henry threw the ball in a steady, relaxed rhythm, his face as friendly and neutral as Noah's. She realized what she had already known. Henry didn't believe any more than he ever had, but was doing this for her, because he loved her. The sound of that love was in the thwack of the ball in Tommy's old mitt, and the sound of her love for Henry and Tommy and Charlie and Noah was in the clicking of the wind in the leaves overhead, all of it making a web of sound that caught her and held her in this moment, right here, right now. She sat back and watched Henry and Noah toss the ball back and forth, like fathers and sons, and men and boys, anywhere, anytime. "Now, let's see you try a pop-up," Henry said, and he threw the ball straight up into the sky. Janie wrote to Anderson. She thought it might be useful for him to keep track of what was happening with Noah, in case they did a new edition of his book. Now that normality reigned in her land, in all its hectic glory, she liked to remind herself sometimes of where they had been. She and Jerry hadn't been friends, but they had shared a deeper connection. They were allies. She wrote about Denise and Henry's visit, giving him all the pertinent data, how much Noah had enjoyed it without recognizing either one of them. She sent the email, and then another one. But he didn't write her back. She hoped he was all right. She had seen him only once, when he had stopped by to visit and give her a copy of his book, a few months before he left the country again for good. The reviews of his book had been mixed. Some critics had responded to his research by attacking him playfully, as if it was all a misunderstood game of telephone or fraudulence, nothing to take seriously. And others had been interested in his findings, but hadn't known what to make of them. Anderson hadn't seemed to care, though. He'd been much quieter, and also somehow looser, as if some tight string had been snapped. He was wearing a white shirt with pockets, the kind of thing island people wore. She had mentioned that, and he'd actually laughed. "That's true. I'm an island person now," he'd said. Janie didn't want to forget everything that had happened. But she couldn't help herself. Daily life was too insistent. She was busy with work, the pleasure of creating harmonious spaces, the headache of quibbling clients. To her great surprise and delight, Bob, her erstwhile texting fling, had entered her life, responding to her sheepish text, "If you still want to get together, let me know," with enthusiasm. They'd been seeing each other once or twice a week for 6 months now, long enough for her to begin to believe that it might actually be happening, and to think about, maybe someday, introducing him to Noah. And, of course, there was Noah to look after, monitoring his homework, handling his dinner and bubble bath, how much pleasure she took now in ordinary life, keeping up with all the needs of his ever-evolving self. He was getting older. Sometimes when they were riding their bikes in the park, she let him pull a little bit ahead of her on the path. And as she watched his blonde head and narrow back and small pumping legs cycling away from her and around the bend, she felt a pang of loss that she knew was only ordinary motherhood. One night she woke up in a panic, sure she was losing something precious, and she went to Noah's room and watched him sleep. The nightmares, thank goodness, had stopped long ago. Once she was content on that score, she turned on her computer and checked her email. There it was at last, Jerry Anderson's name in her inbox. No subject heading. She opened it quickly.
Beach.
He had written. All caps. Nothing else. The words resonated through the silence of the apartment, causing ripples of alarm and relief. Are you all right? She wrote. The screen cast a strange, pale light in the darkness, and she felt his presence rise up at that moment. As if he were right there with her. Jerry? I'm fine. She imagined him saying this, though he'd written nothing back. It was a feeling she had, though whether it was true or made up, she didn't know. Still, it calmed her to think she could feel him there, across that vast space. The next day, Janie was on her way to get Noah from after school, thinking a million thoughts at once, when suddenly she stopped. She looked around. She was standing in a subway car, feeling the motion beneath her feet. The train pulled up from underground, up and out over the Manhattan Bridge, the early evening light shining on the river, on a boat carting its cargo from here to there, on the people in the subway car, every detail leaping forward with a heightened, tender clarity. The Band-Aid on the knee of the teenager across from her, the spiky hair of the woman reading next to him, the Rastafarian's lips moving beneath his beard as he chewed gum. Inside the subway car, advertisements for beer, storage space, mattresses. Wake up and rejuvenate your life. I've been wrong, she thought suddenly. What had happened to Noah had seemed to separate her from other people who didn't know the story. Or, when she tried to explain it to her closest friends, couldn't believe in that stuff. So, she had put it away, kept it to herself, as if it was yet another thing keeping her subtly apart, when in fact, the implications suggested otherwise. What were the implications? So many lifetimes. So many people loved and lost and found again. Relatives you didn't know you had. Maybe she'd been related to someone in this very subway car. Maybe that guy with the suit and the iPad, or the Rasta chewing gum, or the blonde man with the polka dot shirt and the fern sticking out of his bag, or the woman with the bristly hair. Perhaps one of them had been her mother, or her lover, or her son, the dearest of the dear, or would be next time around, so many lifetimes. It stands to reason that they were all related. They'd forgotten, that's all. It wasn't a hippy-dippy campfire song. Well, okay, it was, but it wasn't just that. It was real. But how is that possible? It didn't matter how. It was. She looked around the car. The olive-skinned man next to her was reading a newspaper ad for a matchmaker. The kid across from her was jiggling a skateboard on his banged-up knees. The dearest of the dear, she thought. She was feeling punchy. It would be hard to live that way. To look at other people that way, but you could try, couldn't you? The doors between the cars flung apart, and a man emerged. Homeless. Shuffling into the subway car on grimy bare feet. His hair was matted into a coarse helmet, and his clothes. She couldn't look too closely at his clothes. He lumbered unsteadily through the car. His smell was like a force field, repelling everything in its path. When the subway finally stopped and the doors opened, new people stepped in with one foot and turned right back around to go to another car. Most of the people already in the car left in droves. Some stayed put, though, decided to bear it out. They were too tired to get up or too distracted by their handheld devices, or they didn't want to give up their seats. Their stops were coming up soon, and anyway, that was the car they'd picked, the hand they'd been dealt this time around. They looked carefully away from him. They were afraid to draw his attention. She was the only one looking in his general direction, so he walked right up to her. He stood there, swaying in front of her, his smell making her eyes water. He didn't have a jar or anything. He held out a dirty palm. She pulled 3/4 from her pocket and placed them on his palm. And as she did so, her fingers brushed against his hand, and she looked up. His eyes were a caramel color, bright around the pupils and darker at the edges. And peering into them was like looking into a double eclipse. He had thick lashes, brushed with soot. He blinked.
"Hey, thanks, sister," he said.
"You're welcome." His face seemed to spring forward, his needs and hopes etched clearly there, as if he had been waiting all this time for her to notice him.
Paul lost 20 pounds that first year. He got shuffled around the prison as if he was a piece of paper on the ground being stepped on with muddy boots. He couldn't sleep. He'd lie there in the top bunk, breathing in the smell of urine from the toilet in the corner, and listening to the prison sounds of dripping and snoring and yelling. He didn't know if the yelling was the other inmates screaming in their sleep, or if they were pushed into wakefulness by their own misery, as he was. And underneath it all, the never-ending echo of Tommy Crawford calling him from the bottom of the well. He had long ago stopped trying not to think of Tommy Crawford. What he'd done was in the threads of his prison clothes and the grout between the cement bricks and the cat piss smell that permeated everything. Sometimes he still wished he could go back and do it all differently, but he couldn't. Other times he wondered why life was like that. You did stupid things and couldn't take them back no matter how much you wanted to. There were no second chances. He had said that to his lawyer once, and the woman had pursed her lips, looking at him across the table like somebody's sad mother. She was a woman in her 50s, thin, with bushy gray-blonde hair tied back with a rubber band and blue eyes that always looked as if she'd been up all night worrying about him. He didn't know why she would do a thing like that when he wasn't even related to her, but he was grateful for her services and that he would get out of prison someday, though he would almost be 30 by then. One day after a year or so had passed, they told him that he had a visitor. He thought it must be his lawyer or his mom. The guard brought him down the long hallway and into the room where the tables were. When he saw who it was, he wanted to back up out of the room, but it was too late. She was sitting there, waiting for him. Her hair was grayer now than it had been in the hearing, but her face was the same. And her eyes turning to him looked like Tommy Crawford's eyes when he was trying to decide whether or not he should go with him into the woods to practice shooting. He wished he could hide under the table. She picked up the phone on the other side of the heavy, scuffed glass, so he did too. "I got your letter," she said. He looked at her. He couldn't think of any words to say. He had written a letter about how sorry he was about what happened to Tommy. How he had liked Tommy, and wished that Tommy was alive and he was dead. Everything he wrote was true. His lawyer had thought it might help if they went to court, but then they had plea bargained and he had sent the letter anyway, thinking the parents would never respond. Why would they? "You said in the letter that you're an alcoholic." Her voice was low. She didn't meet his gaze through the glass. "Is this true?" He mumbled, then forced himself to say it. "Yes." He was used to admitting it now, after all those AA meetings in prison. "But you're sober now?" He nodded, then realized there was no way she could see him with her head bent down like that. "Yes." "Is that why it happened? Because you were drunk?" She was looking at her hands on the table in front of her. He swallowed. His throat was dry. There was no water here.
"No."
"Then why?" She glanced up. Her eyes were sad, but they had no anger in them.
"It was an accident,"
he said, and saw that shadow of skepticism, that downward twitch of the lips that had crossed so many faces since he had confessed.
"But that's not why," he added.
It was because I was a coward. A coward and an idiot. He bent his head, too. He looked down at their hands, the two long brown ones, the two stubby white ones with the nails half chewed off. She made a noise on the other end of the phone. He couldn't tell what kind of noise it was. "I'm sorry I killed your son," he said into the phone. The words were garbled because his throat was so thick and so dry. He put his head down on his arms and hoped the guards didn't think he was crying. He was, a little bit, but that was beside the point. He felt she was waiting for him to say something else. He wasn't sure what. And then he knew. He took the phone into the cradle of his arms and said the rest. "I know you can't forgive me." Forgive. It wasn't a word he had ever used before recently. Wanting forgiveness was a part of him now. He craved it like he craved alcohol. There was a long silence. "It's funny," she said at last, though there was nothing funny in the whole world as far as Paul could tell. He looked up and her face was calm. "I've been thinking about that." She spoke like a teacher, someone who knew something. "The Bible says, forgive and you will be forgiven. And the Buddhists, of course, believe that hatred only leads to further hatred and suffering. As for me, I don't know. I know I don't want to hold on to hatred anymore. I can't."
Her eyes lingered on his face, as if she was deciding whether or not he was hideous. It occurred to him that wanting forgiveness meant you had to give it, too. He knew he hadn't forgiven his dad for some things. He couldn't imagine doing that.
"Tommy's teaching me every day," she continued, and he nearly fell right off his seat. How could Tommy be teaching her anything? "He's forcing me to let go of him," she said, "to surrender to the moment at hand. There's joy there, if you can do it."
He couldn't believe she was sitting there talking about learning something from her dead son, talking about joy to him, to him. Maybe he'd driven her crazy and he'd have that on his conscience too.
"How is it here?" she asked quietly. "Is it bad?"
He couldn't tell whether she wanted to hear that it was or it wasn't.
"It's what I deserve, I guess," he said simply. She didn't dispute it, but she didn't seem happy about it either.
"I'd like you to write me," she said. "Will you do that? I want to know what it's like in here and how you're getting on. I want to know the truth."
"Okay."
He thought that he would tell her, too, even if she was crazy. He could tell her all the things he'd been through here that he didn't want his own mom to know about.
"So we've got ourselves a deal?" she said.
He nodded. She stood up. She belted her coat tightly across her waist. She was thin, like something that could break in 2 seconds, and at the same time he felt that she was probably tougher than he could ever hope to be. She lifted her hand up to him and waved goodbye, a smile passing across her face, there and gone, so quick he wasn't sure if he'd imagined it. After the visit, he stabilized a bit. He stopped hating the feel of the scratchy uniform on his skin, and the way one moment slammed into the next moment with no room for wriggling free except for the novels he got out from the prison library and the GED class he was taking, and the visits from his mom to see how he was doing. He wrote letters to Mrs. Crawford, telling her the truth. He woke every morning from a heavy, dreamless slumber, still surprised to find himself there. The people in the novels he was reading lived in peat and stone dwellings in hilly lands covered in mist, and they raised dragons and learned magic. They passed on their secrets from mother to son. Anderson felt the warm water licking at his feet. He walked in slowly, aware at every moment that he could turn back, the water encompassing his calves and his sore knees, his thighs and his chest. He was unsure of what he was going to do until the last moment the sandy ground slid beneath his feet, and he was swimming.
and even then he glanced back and saw the shore so close, and his sandals and his book right there, waiting for him. The beach was empty. It was too early for tourists, and there were no fishermen on this side of the island. It was as if he was the only one in the whole world who was a